have a problem every year around MLK Day because Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., for some reason, has been treated as America's civil rights mascot. On this day, you'll have folks who would have never in their life marched with, agreed with, voted with anything he believed in. One of the biggest in the United States Congress. He had the audacity to send out a Dr. King quote.
The march has begun. Every day we rise like the sun. We fight till the battle is won. Can you hear the footsteps? Listen, because we're coming like a gang on the street. So you better start running.
Hi, and welcome to another episode, another edition of On Another Level. I'm your producer and host, Sharon Eaton Hinton. As always, we're live on a Monday night. We're always live at 6:30, Comcast Channel 6. It changed from 23. They got some gospel station on there now. They ain't paying us, so I'm not going to promote it. But we won't be able to take phone calls because we have four guests and me. That's five people. Divine number. And we're going to be talking about a divine inspiration that these people have gotten about black people. Black Lives Matter in schools and everywhere. I also have a radio podcast, Black Teachers Matter. So Black Lives Matter, Black Teachers Matter. But that is on WBCA on Tuesday nights. We're here on a Monday night. And we're talking to the Solidarity and United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen. What is freedmen? You think you're free? Land of the free, home of the brave? Well, if you are a descendant of slaves, if you're a person of color, especially a dark-skinned person of color, you might want to check that out. This evening, we're going to be talking about what it means about being a freedman or woman and going to get your money. Show me the money with reparations. Don't go anywhere. We got some information for you. It's happening right now on Another Level.
Flying outside City Hall, people with offices inside the building are working on solutions for the city's black residents. Tonight in Roxbury, the mayor's task force on reparations announced the two research teams that will study Boston's role in the transatlantic slave trade and its long-term impact on descendants. A team from Tufts will research the period of time between 1620 and 1940. A team from Northeastern University will look at 1940 to the present.
The past will inform us because we have some good people, and that's what we want our researchers to bring forward.
The findings will eventually guide recommendations for reparations for black residents.
So that was a really short clip. Thank you, CBS News, we're not paying you. And a good friend of mine, Joe Feaster, who is chairing up the City of Boston Reparations Commission. That's the City of Boston. Then you have another group, that's the Boston People's Reparation Commission. Then you got another group, that's a statewide, which I just found out about last week at the reparations meeting at the Bowling Building. Then you have the federal group that started way, way back that initiated H.R. 40, which is a federal legislation to try and go get me my money. That's right, I'm making this real personal. My grandparents are from Mississippi, Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina. I had a clip that talked about how you can actually find out where people came from and just, you know, this is about to be a real controversial show. A really good friend of mine, Leo the Emancipator, had a show and he actually had live phone calls and the phones were flooded. I can't do that tonight because we have people in the studio who know what's happening and they're taking it from a different angle because Miss Antonia Edwards.
Thank you.
I had it right the first
you
time.
You did.
Antonia Edwards and Mr. Jonathan
Bryant
are here in the studio with me. We have two people that are actually going to come in and join us on Zoom, but I want to start with the people that are here. Sure. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us. I really appreciate you reaching out to me.
You know, this is one of like several shows because this is ongoing.
It's ongoing and there's so much information. You just can't capsulize it in an hour show. There's just so much information.
The more I delve into this, I have to do it in pieces.
Yes.
Because I just get too angry.
You get angry, overwhelmed, and there's too much data, too much information that you have to retain. And so that's why we give workshops, because we try to break it down as much as possible to people when we're talking to them. It's something that you just can't learn overnight.
And I got to give credit to my girl, young queen Carrie Mays.
Yes,
because
Carrie.
She's the one
I love
that
her.
Introduced me to you. And I am all down for intergenerational, cross-generational. Yes. We have to do this together.
Yes.
So I've been following her and supporting her. And she was the one that told me about you. And you have actually introduced me to the other three guests. Jonathan is here.
Yes.
And Ali and Naheem are on Zoom. Hopefully they're on Zoom. And so tell me, and I saw you at the meeting at the bowling building. And I joked. No, I wasn't joking.
You weren't
when
joking.
I got up and I spoke and I said, I have a pain in my neck. I literally had a pain in my neck.
You did. You did. You could tell.
Because I was sitting there and I was listening to people. And it's not like anything they said wasn't valid.
Right.
But it's just, I'm not the type of person that meets to go to a meeting because we met because we need another meeting. I can't.
Right.
I've been here too long. My birthday is tomorrow.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to me. And I'll be 69.
Mm-hmm.
Friday, which was a gift from one of my students, my former student, he's like my spiritual son, mm-hmm. we got to see Patti LaBelle.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You seen her on the 22nd? My cousin went.
Patti LaBelle is 79.
Yes. Yeah. And she's still doing
it. And she outlived her three sisters who died in their 40s.
Yes.
And just this, I mean, 79, looking fabulous, strutting the whole stage and the whole thing. And then last week, we lost... a library. We lost an icon. We lost an elder, Sarah Ann Shaw.
Yes, we
Sarah Ann Shaw has, she knew me all my life.
Yes, I grew up with her. Yep.
Mm-hmm. All my life.
Mm-hmm.
Her daughter, Claire,
mm-hmm.
and Ellen Jackson's daughter, Veronica,
mm-hmm.
me, Claire, and mm-hmm. Ronnie grew up together because all three of our parents were in the Black Power struggle.
Oh, wow. Condolences to her family. Yeah, thank you.
You know, there's going to be... there's going to be high up. There's Ali. Oh, there they are.
Mm-hmm.
Ali and Naeem.
Yes.
And so there's going to be a memorial or some kind of mm-hmm. celebration at the end of April.
Sure.
And so those of you who are on Facebook or whatever, you know, just keep apprised. I'm sure it's going to be in the news.
Yes, please.
Sometimes, which is the value of us being here at BNN Media, we're in the community.
Yes.
And so we try to give you timely news.
Thank you.
Sometimes people find out until it's over.
Okay.
And so we don't have any particular
You'll
dates.
Make sure I know though, because I want to be there.
You got to find out just like I got to find out. But I'm sure Claire is being deluged with a lot of different things now. And so our prayers and condolences, because you know what this is, I ran the race.
Mm-hmm.
I fought the fight, right?
She did.
Now the fight is over. But our fight is still here.
Still here.
And it began before we were here.
Yes.
And hopefully we get some resolution before we go.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me where you are in the fight and where the Solidarity and United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen. What's the difference between, I know the difference, but I want you to say like who you are in this fight, because
mm-hmm.
you're a CEO and a founder, you're a co-founder
mm-hmm.
of this whole organization. Ali and Naheem are co-founders,
mm-hmm.
and then they're parts of other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are all over the place, like Savoir Fair. You're everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
And you have to be.
We have to be.
Because this has so many tentacles.
It does.
Because it's been around for hundreds of years.
Exactly.
So why is there a need for another group? And why is it named Freedmen? And why is it specifically Sons and Daughters of Freedmen?
So I'm going to say from my perspective, but I'll let the gentleman understand that. There's a lot of grassroots organizations that are working in silo. And they're all working for different things, but it seems like they're working for an all Black Lives Matter initiative or agenda. We at United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen, we all have a likeness because we come from emancipated slaves. We are the original Harm Party and we're the descendants of that. So we collaborate across the nation, just like any other national group with the Jewish people, the Japanese, the Native Americans. So we have a likeness and a kindness with each other.
And everybody else that got reparations but us.
Exactly. And so we basically collaborate because we all are descendants of slaves. And so the brothers can tell you how they came up with the name. Naheem is right there. He actually is the president.
Well, I want to start with this brother that's in the studio right next to you.
Oh, well, Sister Antonia and I, well, hello, hi. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, you're welcome.
Sister Antonia and I met in 2018.
Right before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, right before the pandemic. And through the work, you know, we formed Solidarity. And through that, we were doing reparation work, doing events, you know, educating people,
mm-hmm.
passing out the books from Here to Equality by Dr. Darity. At several events, this is what we were doing. Through social media and everything, we met the United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen. They can tell you how they came up with that name, but Solidarity, yes. That was the beginning with Sister Antonia and myself.
Now, Ali keeps going on and off camera. I'm not sure if he has something. So I want to go to Naheem first. Hi, Brother Naheem. How are you? I can't hear you. So I need audio brought up. Whoever's in the audio. Are you on mute? Because you're on Zoom. There you go. Now I can hear you. Yes, sir. And I'm seeing good. It's like the Juneteenth symbol behind you, but I can't really see with Freedmen. Something
like that. That's a part of one of our logos that I have in the background. It says Freedmen First. You know, a part of what we do. And first, thanks for having me. And thanks to Sister Antonia and Brother Jonathan for, you know, bringing me onto your platform as well. I am Naheem Wade. I am president and co-founder of United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen. And, in this fight for reparative justice, we understand that there is a specific harm party. There's a specific group of people that have experienced harms generationally since slavery and since emancipation. In fact, there were signs that were drawn that said that we would be treated worse than we were treated in slavery. Mm-hmm. And by many accounts and instances, we were. And so my team and I, after doing some intense research on the Reconstruction era, we realized that this term freedman was a status. And it was something that we were being called as a kind of like an ethnic name back during Reconstruction. It was a way to recognize our manhood and our womanhood. So you would see that term, freedmen and freedwoman, with freedmen encompassing male and female, but you would still see it in that variation, freedmen and freedwomen. But the daughters of the Confederacy, who drafted up what we know in history as the Lost Cause teachings, they wrote out that part of the history to whereas we called or were being called freedmen. And instead, they kept referring to us by the names that we were called during slavery, Black, Negro especially, and colored people. And so we started our organization to counter the generational narrative of the Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans by naming our organization the United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen. So that's basically how that name comes into fruition.
Now, you also started, and you do a lot of your work, the community work in Georgia. And so you went through a lot of efforts, and you're just talking about that, establishing that term, which was already actually established, because that was, you know, during Reconstruction, after we were, according to the slave narratives, just let out, just like you let cattle out. Like, there was no property. There was a promise of 40 acres and a mule. And then after Lincoln was assassinated, the next president came in and said, never mind, we ain't doing that. And then you had, you know, the White Citizens Council and the Ku Klux Klan and all these people that we had no protection against except for ourselves. And then the black clothes, I'm saying this for y'all because it's, you know, not for y'all in the studio with me because y'all already know. But the ones of you guys who are on the air that are not taught this history, I'm a teacher. I've been an educator mm-hmm. for 45 years, and I'm also a student. Mm-hmm. So as we unearth graves, literally graves, mm-hmm. that are under parking lots or under buildings or under new development, and we see graves of formerly enslaved Africans, mm-hmm. enslaved human beings that built this country be denied something that we worked for.
Exactly.
And so, you know, and so here's where I'm about to get in trouble. Uh-oh. And y'all forgive me if I've offended you and stepped on your toe. Just say, ouch. There are people coming to the table who are claiming money that their ancestors did not work for. Boom. I said it. Get mad at me. But if you come to me on the street, don't come to me unless I called you, right? I called these people here tonight to explain the difference between what is being established. And I have a Black Lives Matter t-shirt on in schools because I'm Black and it matched and it was clean. So, and it was along the theme of Black Lives Matter, but all Black people, people of color, are not necessarily entitled to reparations.
Yes.
And I was at a community meeting where a noted elected official, and I won't say who she is because it may be embarrassing after I say what I'm about to say, said that she stood up there and she is an advocate for African Americans to get reparations first. I'm an advocate for black people, formerly descendants of formerly enslaved Africans, to get reparations only. All these people that are coming in to this country, all skin folk ain't kinfolk.
Exactly.
And there was a diaspora of people about liberation, including Marcus Garvey, who was a Jamaican. And when he was asked, are you a Jamaican or you're an African? He said, why would I trade an island for a continent? So I'm appealing to everyone who is hearing me, white, black, slip line, a gliding, pink polka dot, or whatever. Do what is right,
exactly,
not what is convenient or easy. And think of this way. Tomorrow is my birthday. I'm excited. But if all the people and the gifts and everything that people are giving to me for my birthday, somebody else came up and took my gifts, I'd be heated. And that's the way I feel about this reparations. People are trying to show up to get money that my people already work for, to get benefits of my people not only work for and have not received, but people are still receiving the benefits, and I know it's hard on everybody.
It is.
It's hard on poor white folk. But feel me, that privilege that you don't even recognize that you have, that we know that we don't even get, immigrants, the privilege they're giving you, housing allowances, housing, food allowances, the right to vote, give a license, and all of my people died for that. Recognize and read the history of the people that you are being taught to hate and to not unify with. We will only win this together. So I'm going back to Deshaun, popularly known as Naheem, CEO, president, co-founder of United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen, and the Be the Power Incorporated, a political education and advocacy group. Talk to me a little bit about the Be the Power advocacy group.
Yes, Be the Power is a concept that we developed around 2012, 2013, and it came with a model based on the fact that there was too much complaining about what was happening in the sphere of politics and not enough doing. And a part of that, a part of our sentiment was, you will never be able to just fight the power. At some point, you're going to have to become the power. We're going to have to get out of this thinking that we can't be politicians, or we can't be lawyers, or we can't be judges, we can't be cops and correctional officers and sheriffs. You know, part of the power structure of this country, and this is why they control all of these areas for the most part, is because we've generationally rejected a lot of these positions. You know I was taught that politician was bad, being a cop was bad, right? Being a sheriff, who would do that? That's like a betrayal. But ultimately, this was something that was put into our head. We like to call it European psychology over here, by so-called white supremacists, so that we would never have the power to materially change the conditions of our people. And so around 2012, 2013, we came up with the concept, Be the Power, with the motto, don't just fight the power, become the power, then you'll have the power to make a change. And around 2019, we linked up with the grassroots reparationist organizations from all across the country, and our concept of Be the Power has spread. We have several people who are running for office in this country based off of watching our platform and consuming our content.
So tell me a little bit, and I'm going off script a little bit, but you brought me there, bro. Stacey Abrams, if it was not for Stacey Abrams in Georgia, Biden and Kamala Harris would not be in office right now. But yet and still, when she ran for governor again, nobody stepped up for her from the White House. How does that feel, being in Georgia, being in the South, the belly of the beast, which, you know, Mississippi, Mississippi, is just different in terms of methodology. The objective is the same. You're on the ground. What are the people saying about politics, especially because this is a presidential election year? Where is the grassroots rumbling coming from?
Well, right now, and this kind of ties into Stacey Abrams, What you're seeing, especially in Georgia, you know, Democrats and their punditry class have a fear that black men are going to vote for Trump or whoever the Republican candidate is, because we don't know if Trump is going to be locked up or not by the time the election comes. You know, but we're seeing a shift to the Republican Party. And this shift started to happen after Stacey Abrams' gubernatorial run. So, and she was close because she was able to build a certain type of coalition, and that coalition did help elect senators Warnock and Senator Ossoff, if I'm saying his name correctly. But what happened was, when you run on promises that you do not intend to keep, it has a trickle down effect. Mm-hmm. And so when you try to run again, and you and black men particularly are voicing their concerns to you, and you're using the same playbook, then what's going to happen is you're going to start to get this rejection. And this is what happened with Stacey Abrams. She wouldn't sit down with Killer Mike and those people that she needed to have these specific sit downs with. But Brian Kemp went and sat down with Killer Mike, and Killer Mike was able to express to him the sentiment of black Americans, the American freedmen, as we call them, in the state of Georgia, and the things that concern us. And one of the things that I can say is that Kemp, since re-election, has fired off a host of new legislation. And some of those things I can say, maybe, you know, a few years down the line will actually benefit, you know, our family in Georgia, as well, obviously, as all Georgians. But that message wasn't one that was received by Stacey Abrams. She was running the old Democratic playbook, which was really ignore black men. And that's where the issue came in. That is the number one issue. Mm. Then, real quick, she started a campaign where she was going to try to attract black men. And she put up this piece on her website. But when you read the body of the text of what she was planning, none of it was specific for our men. And we're still talking about doing everything for everybody else. And that was the turnoff. And I think that's why she lost in that second election.
Wow. And then the other thing that most black people, and I saw how you are really a student of history. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's really a student of history knows that, you know, the majority of black people were Republicans mm-hmm. before the 60s. And then Hubert Humphrey came out and he didn't want to support the civil rights legislation. And that's when black people became Democrats. So we've shifted on both sides. And most people don't remember that the White Citizens Council and the Ku Klux Klan were Democrats, and they were card-carrying so-called Christian Democrats. So for us to be affiliated for any particular party that doesn't have a black agenda and our agenda in mind, and that includes black men and women, black people, mm-hmm. period, you know, children, elders, you know, one of the reasons why, and I'm old enough to remember, the civil rights movement was so successful is because we focused on liberation, period. And that was the playbook that Latinos, Chicanos, because you had the Brown Berets, you had the Black Panthers, Native Americans, they took our playbook mm-hmm. and Asian Americans effectively executed what we had executed, but what they didn't have against them was bombs. We're the only people in this country that the United States government has dropped bombs on
exactly.
repeatedly. I think we got them back. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break. And there's a kind of a long piece, but I want people to stay with me through this. And we're going to see if we have Ali. Thank you, Brother Naheem. We want you to stay there. Ali Bay Harrison, he's the co-founder of United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen, National Secretary and Director of History and Research, and co-founder of Be the Power Along with You, Brother Jonathan, Sister Antonia,
thank you.
And you. We want you to stay with us. This piece is long for TV, but it's informative. And we're talking about show me the money. Show me the money, black people. Reparations for black people. You're on another level. I'm Sharon Eaton Hinton, your host. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Black News Tonight. Now, for many Black Americans, the idea of tracing your roots back more than a couple of generations, well, it's often felt like a dream because it wasn't possible for a lot of people. Of course, DNA can provide powerful clues, but a lack of documentation from errors of slavery and Jim Crow can still pose real obstacles for a lot of people. Well, there's good news. African Americans looking to fill out their family trees just got a major boost. The genealogy website Ancestry has released the world's largest collection of records from the Freedmen's Bureau. Now, they've made more than 3.5 million records of African American families, some going back as far as 1846, now available to everyone for free. Yes, I said F-R-E-E, my favorite word, and hopefully yours too. So here to tell us all about it and much more is our next guest, Nika Sewell-Smith. She is a professional genealogist and Ancestry consultant who says that she's obsessed with legacy and tracking down ancestors. Nika, welcome to Black News Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you.
I know, great to see you again. You have been on this mission for many years, and I am excited to talk about this new project. So talk to us about the significance of this move by Ancestry.com and also how these records will help people.
Yeah, so the Freedmen's Bureau is an incredible collection. It's something that I've been using for more than 14 years myself. And when I started the process, it was manual. It was literally like the old school, you know, where you have to pull the drawer out and get the microfilm and, you know, crank with your arm and, you know, be in a dark environment and have like, you know, the perfect circumstances for you to try and find the documents and really be relegated to a small time frame for you to have access to the records. It wasn't something that you could bring home and, you know, at your own, you know, leisure, look through things. And so with this release, with it being the world's largest digitized and searchable, you know, iteration of the Freedmen's Bureau, people have the ability to look through this whenever they want to. And then there's not a cost barrier associated with it either. You can look at it for free. All you need is a free guest registered account on Ancestry. And these records are incredible. What you're looking at, you know, are records from a critical time span. A lot of folks, especially during the pandemic, have really made efforts to try and trace their family history, you know, something that they had been talking about doing for an extended period of time. And they just never got around to doing it until we were all at home. And, you know, people were just thinking about all the things that they wanted to do. And so a lot of folks have garnered interest, but they've gotten back to about 1870 and they hit a roadblock. And a lot of times in African-American genealogy, people call that the brick wall. I like to refer to it as a speed bump, where you need a little push, you know, from a lot of different sources, right? It could be records access. It could be information from a family member. It could be, you know, just knowing how to search through records. But in order to get over that speed bump, you need something critical. And the Freedmen's Bureau is one of those things that can help us get over that time, you know, that block. And it covers the time period primarily from 1865 to 1872. But there are areas in the country that predate that, meaning that the records start during the Civil War. And what you're seeing is the War Department going across the country, primarily in 15 states, and they are trying to help stabilize the country. They are doing things like providing and overseeing labor contracts between landowners and those who were formerly enslaved. And in a lot of instances, those landowners were the former slaveholders of those who are working for them. Or those landowners could be people who came from other parts of the country, like the North and the Midwest, to, you know, lease land from the government that had been abandoned because folks mm-hmm. left the area during the Civil War. Right. So that's but one function that the Freedmen's Bureau have.
And that's why it's such an important resource for Black people trying to trace their families, because so for so many years, they weren't unable to. They hit that bump, you got the speed bump, they hit that. But talk to us a little bit about what the Freedmen's Bureau is and how they even got all of this documentation together.
Right, so the Freedmen's Bureau was started by, it was authorized by Congress in March of 1865, although an iteration of it existed before that in different forms in different states. And so it was really one of the first social service programs that we have that you see, because I just talked about labor contracts. They issued rations and clothing to people. They had schools. In fact, you talk about Howard University. Howard University is actually named after O.O. Howard, who was over the Freedmen's Bureau nationally. They operated hospitals. Howard Hospital was a Freedmen's Bureau hospital. You have other institutions that are HBCUs that literally began, if not as Freedmen's Bureau schools, but as funding sources, you know, getting funding from the Freedmen's Bureau. You have marriages that they were over, meaning those who were formerly enslaved who wanted to get married, they could go to the Freedmen's Bureau and solemnize their marriage. You also have contraband camps. When you hear that word, it's like, well, what do you mean contraband? Well, formerly enslaved people fled from their slaveholders and they would start to follow the Union troops. And in doing so, they would form these camps. And a lot of times the Freedmen's Bureau would disperse services through those camps. You also had, you have to think about the name. The official name is the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands. And the refugees could be poor whites or they could be free people of color. The freedmen were, of course, the formerly enslaved and then the abandoned lands. And so you also had operations like courts, where there were states where black people could not testify against white people. You have proceedings that the Freedmen's Bureau was over that you can find the documents for those things there. Transportation. Let's say you have an ancestor that you have documented in Mississippi and they're born in North Carolina and you've been trying to find who the slaveholder was and you have no leads. There's a possibility that the Freedmen's Bureau paid to send that individual or a family from North Carolina after the war to Mississippi because there was land that needed to be farmed. That's how widespread this organization was. Wow. And the records were gathered up at the time by the National National Archives, mm-hmm. and that's really who kind of had to corral it, because it's a lot.
And that's why these records are so important, because it is a lot. And I think a lot of people think, oh, well, we have the DNA test, I'll just do that. But that doesn't really replace the historical records. So talk to us about how the two can work together, both the DNA and the historical records.
Right. So I always remind people, you don't have DNA without genealogy, and you don't have genealogy without DNA. They work hand in hand. The paper trail gets solidified by the DNA confirming, you know, the connections to individuals, whereas the paper trail itself, right, it's like they cross each other, you know, like they're holding hands walking down the street. And so a lot of times, especially when you talk about the matching, right, where you're trying to figure out how you're related to other people, you don't really have the hard proof until you can get those documents. And in some instances, especially when we're talking about this crucial time span, some of those ancestors did not live to be recorded on the census as free people. So for us to have the ability to find them in records before the 1870 census, but as free people, right? This may be the only time they're recorded. There are people that I see getting rations at 100 years old in 1867. Where else are they going to be documented in records before that time span? And with DNA, you're getting a region. And in some instances, when you're talking about communities like on Ancestry, where it can drill down to a county or a specific set of states, it's pinpointing, right, which is great. But you want to get that day-to-day, that level of granularity that you cannot get from a marriage license sometimes, or even a birth certificate or a death certificate. What was going on in the community? What were relations like between these two sets of folks, you know, who were, you know, non-paid employee and you know, an employer or slaveholder, right? Like, what was that like? What were the conditions like? What can you read in this collection beyond, like, oh my gosh, people advocating for their own autonomy? What do I want to be paid? Who do I want to work for? Can I complain to someone when I'm being mistreated by my employer, or when they're not meeting the terms of the contract? Even children being apprenticed out because their parents cannot be, you know, they can't take care of them, or the community has deemed their parents unfit.
Yeah.
And so all of this is within the records.
Now, Nika, we're almost out of time, but I definitely want to encourage people to go to your web series called Black Pro Gen Live. I mean, you talk about so many things in there about genealogy, helping other people find out their genealogy, and then Trask 250 Multimedia, at this event you have, this on there as well. And you also talk about finding links to, like, 5,400 other relatives, as well as a connection between a slave fugitive in your family and Andrew Jackson, President Jackson. What do you say to those people who are digging through all this information? They don't know how to compartmentalize all the stuff they're getting, that they have slaves in their family, that they have white ancestors, maybe presidents in their family, and different things like this. How do they deal with the emotional impact of all the information that they're finding within their family?
Well, this morning I was thinking about this, and I think a lot of times people stray away from this time span because in some ways, emotionally for us, we're going back on the cotton field or back into the house when we're having to do this. And so you have to really pace yourself. Give yourself the time and the space to be able to work through this. Maybe have a research partner, someone that you can talk to as you discover things, and find someone in your family who's just as interested in it as you are. There are plenty of ways on social media to connect with folks. I'm there. There's more than just me that's there. There are groups on different sites where you can reach out to folks to get help and tips and just emote. You know, give yourself the space to feel the emotions that our ancestors were not really allowed to feel openly. And also really arm your family with the ability to move forward with the knowledge of what happened during that time span so that, you know, no one can tell you who you are. You know who you are. You have it within your heart. And a lot of times, the information has always been there. You just need a document or a little piece of information to bring it out for you.
Yeah, and if you do the research, you might find out you're not who you thought you were before doing the research. So there's a lot to discover. All right.
That's true, too.
There you go. Thank you so much for this fascinating conversation, Nika. We appreciate it.
And so we're back here on Another Level. I'm your host, Sharon Eaton Hinton. Thank you to the Griot Politics. That's what that segment was. That's where the segment came from. For those of you that don't know, the Griot Network is owned by Byron Allen, a black man who also owns the Weather Channel. And he tried to buy and is just still in the process of trying to buy BET back, BET and Paramount, which was on the block. And Tyler Perry, who has the money, who's a billionaire, tried to get it. And all of a sudden, and then Byron Allen, and then they tried to come together to make it happen. And all of a sudden, it's not for sale anymore. Anyway, let me welcome back. And I have all four of you guys, Deshaun, popularly known as Naheem Way, and Charles Ali Bay Harrison. They're both on Zoom. And in the studio with me, I have Queen Antonia.
Thank you.
And King Jonathan, how you doing?
Well, thank you.
Thank you for being here tonight. I know it's intense.
It's intense.
And then when you and I have been at several of the actual in-person meetings on reparations in Boston.
Yes.
And I think now they're only going to be, you know, held monthly. And so one of the controversies was at the last meeting, out of the 9 members of the council, only 2 people were there.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm choking. Because
do you need me to pat you on the back?
No. Sometimes you gotta be in pain when you deal with this stuff. And so I'm trying not to cry and I'm trying to be so angry with our people not coming together when there are billions of dollars being sent to other countries and money being found for people who are not even American citizens. How does that make you feel being head of this Freedmen's Bureau?
I think it is a huge slap in the face. And let me just start off by the fact that my family comes from the South. My grandmother and my grandfather on both sides were sharecroppers because their parents were slaves. So slavery is not that long ago. A lot of people think it's so far removed, but I'm actually 3 generations removed from slavery. And my grandmother was a freedom fighter. And so she made us, after they fled the South to come to get away from the racial terror, she came to Boston only to face the racial terror here. So every summer, I spent my summers down South on the plantation that they actually lived at because one of the cousins was able to buy some property off of it. So I was at the tail end of Jim Crow. So I can't unlearn and unsee what I saw. And that's why this is passionate to me, because my grandmother wanted to make sure I knew where I came from. I think it's absolutely disrespectful, egregious to constantly overlook the people who had 250 years of free slave labor, castrated. They were hung. The baby.
Slave plantations, sex slave plantations.
Yeah, I was going to say ancestral breeding when the ships didn't go over. Then you had them feeding babies to alligators. You had all kinds of recreational things that they did, horrible things.
The postcards, the lynchings
and stuff like that. The picnic comes from the fact of lynching. A lot of people don't know that. And then we had the Reconstruction, where the promises of the 40 acres and a mule was reneged on, and then all those benefits went to white slave owners after they got paid for losing.
Slave owners got reparations.
They got reparations from England and also from the United States because they felt like they lost their property, so
and
they were
now. And that's the same thing that happened to Haiti. Which is mm-hmm. why Haiti is in such a bad situation
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
And they're dropping off, when I say they, mm-hmm. there are American planes, mm-hmm. Airlines dropping off Haitians in America. Mm-hmm. I think they should, Sakbase, mm-hmm. Naboule, okay? I'm not dogging my Haitian brothers mm-hmm. and sisters. I'm identifying with your history. The first free black country mm-hmm. in the Western Hemisphere.
Exactly.
But the European powers got together and had an embargo and said, either you pay us for the property that we lost, which
right.
is reparations,
right.
or else we're going to wage war. And they couldn't
and
afford
they
to wage war.
And they did that for again. The last hundreds of years.
And so now that's why they're so poor. And then we're mm-hmm. wondering why, because we're not being taught this history of our people.
Mm-hmm. So I just feel as though we've never been acknowledged. The work, the badges and incidents of slavery that we just spoke about have never been acknowledged. And for some reason, there's not one race of people who has been treated like we have in America. We had the Japanese internment camps. They were paid reparations.
We had Italian-Americans.
Italian-Americans as well, too.
Asian-Americans,
Asians,
Japanese.
Asians-Americans. And the Native Americans, they received their reparations as well, too. And the biggest thing that people throw in our face is Jewish, the Jewish reparations. But that didn't happen here. So we're the only group of people that faced the atrocities in the United States and Black Wall Street and the 34 massacres across the United States, whatever, and have never been acknowledged and never been repaired. So when I look around and I see all other groups of people being funded, whether it be the new immigrants that are coming in now with the $7,000 to $9,000 credit cards and the housing, the food, whatever, it just really breaks my heart. And we're always, when we speak of our lineage, it's like, oh, you're just whining, you're just complaining. We're the only group of people that can't talk about our heritage.
No. It's even, oh, just forget about that. They want us to remember the Alamo, remember 9/11,
exactly.
forget about that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we can't talk freely about our heritage. We can't talk freely about what we've been through, good, bad, or ugly, and without offending somebody. So I purposely make sure that I'm in a community every day educating people on our lineage. It's not taught in schools. A lot of the adults,
on purpose,
a lot of the adults don't really know it because at a certain point after civil rights, we stopped talking about it.
But then also, and I experienced this, and I want to bring in Brother Ali.
Yes, thank you.
Who knows a lot about the legislative history and the background about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to welcome him into the conversation because we've, you know, it's mm-hmm. towards the end of the show, brother, but we got to acknowledge you and get you in here. So when you look at on purpose, mm-hmm. this erasure,
it's
of
an
our
erasure
history,
of our history.
Erasure of our pain.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that we have been complicit in that because we're allowing our children. Malcolm said, only a fool will let your enemy educate your kids. I'm a teacher.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's not being taught to our kids in the home, because
mm-hmm.
we know they're not going to do it mm-hmm. in the schools because it's going
right.
to empower our kids to teach our kids who they are, it's incumbent upon us to find out who we are and
exactly.
to teach our children and our
exactly.
children's children. So it's on two hands. Welcome, Brother Ali. Thank you. I see you in your car. You traveling. Please be safe while
yes.
you're traveling. But I want to introduce you. Give us some of the background in terms of legislation, because we didn't really talk about that. We just talked about H.R. 40. And you're a co-founder of United Sons and Daughters of Freedmen, the National Secretary and Director of History and Research, and a co-founder, along with Brother Naeem, of Be the Power. So political education and advocacy is your thing. I also want to say that you have some history with the great Patti LaBelle, and I just saw her performing Friday for my birthday. She is still at 79, killing it, man. Her voice is perfection. She is powerful. A 90-minute show, and she was doing her thing. So you and I have a connection, and you didn't even know that. But as a matter of fact, the other connection is that my daughter, as a baby, met Patti LaBelle, and we didn't have cameras back then when she had her perfume and she was promoting it in Boston if I leave.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, who little pretty little baby is that? And so she holding my baby
Aww.
And had hot sauce in her bag. So you and I go back to you didn't even know about. But this connection tonight,
right.
tell me about the legislation and why you are so passionate and so involved in this particular movement for the sons and daughters of freedmen.
Wow. Well, first off, thank you for having me. And I am in transit coming from work. So
I apologize for the background and in and out. The signal is not great. In terms of the legislative history of reparations, what we find is that for us as a class of people in this country, the legislative history for us goes back to the Reconstruction period, obviously. The 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, this, you know, the so-called Reconstruction Amendments, those things, specifically the 13th Amendment, the way it was construed or constructed by and interpreted by the Supreme Court was that the 13th Amendment actually gives Congress the power to eradicate all of the badges and incidents of slavery. Now, had they fully identified and done exactly that, we probably would not be here right now talking about reparations. So Congress has never really done its job in terms of the actual remedial justice that was due to our people ever since the time of Reconstruction.
But also in the 13th Amendment, and for those people who want to learn more about it, there are documentaries, the 13th Amendment, and there's a proviso in that amendment that says slavery is abolished except if you're incarcerated. And so that's contributed to the mass incarceration of our people because the black codes came along during that same time and said if you're a vagrant, meaning you didn't have a job, you could be picked up for anything and you could be incarcerated. And then prisoners had less rights than people who were formerly enslaved, because if you had property, at least you wanted to protect your property because you still wanted to bring the crops. But the slaves, they worked the slaves, they worked the imprisoned people worse than the slaves and worked them to death. And basically, and just grabbed them off the street and said, you know, what you doing? And also the lynching, if you look at the history of the lynching, it's usually business people, and it was people who were standing up for their rights who weren't getting paid. And so then the response from the white community, I'm gonna say it, is that just to kill them. Kill them, kill their kids.
Yes.
Black Wall Street was named, Tulsa was named that because it was more prosperous. And so these rumors, and white women, you're not innocent in this. You know, whispering that, oh, he touched me, he looked at me, he whistled at me. Let's talk about Emmett Till now.
Yes.
When black men have been criminalized because you got too much bass in your voice, or you're looking a man in his eyes, and you want to be treated like a man and not like a dog, or less than a dog, because, you know, people care for their pets more than they care for black people. Come on down. So y'all ain't gonna like me. You gonna see me? You gonna see me in Stop and Shop in South Bay? Maybe not South Bay, because South Bay is kind of shutting down. But you gonna see me in the street because I live here. Mm-hmm. And you better come correct. And you better be researched if you don't like what I'm saying. Too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got an opinion. So the whole mass incarceration thing, would you say has come out of and been and been used by that 13th
yes.
Amendment?
Yes.
Absolutely. It's the way that the courts construe, because, you know, the courts have what they call discretion, and they can construe laws to be used in certain types of ways. The interesting thing about that particular provision of the 13th Amendment is that it actually came from the Northwest Ordinance. And so it's not something that was put in place specifically for the 13th Amendment as some type of means to re-enslave the newly freed or emancipated people. It actually does have its rooting in the Northwest Ordinance. But the thing about it is we have a theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my brothers and I have a theory about that particular provision based on the history of what was going on at that time. So, you know, the Civil War just ended, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, the Civil War has ended, and you have a bunch of people who attempted to overthrow the United States. Then you have a group of people called the Radical Republicans, Thaddeus Stevens, etc. These people who were trying to, if you research the history of these particular guys, they were actually trying to stomp out the Confederacy. Thaddeus Stevens and people like John Bingham and others. So what we believe, and this is just a theory, what we believe, what they were attempting to do with that provision was use that provision to then enslave those Confederates who just attempted to overthrow the United States. Why am I saying that? Because if you look at that particular history, some of those men were supposed to stand trial for treason, one of them being Jefferson Davis. They didn't follow through with those trials. They didn't follow through with those trials, but think about what would have happened had they put those men on trial for treason and found them guilty. You would have had a mass incarceration by way of the 13th Amendment of a whole bunch of former Confederates. Mm-hmm.
So hold up. So we're running out of time, but I gotta bring this in here because that same provision is trying to be the current Republicans are trying to erase that mm-hmm. because people are trying to use that against Donald Trump.
Yes.
And say that he actually fostered sedition against the United States government. What are your opinions? Give me about 60 seconds of your opinions on that.
Well, absolutely. They're trying to get rid of that. They would love to get rid of the 14th Amendment was even being used with the whole trying to overthrow the election, mm-hmm. right? There's a provision of the 14th Amendment that they were trying to use. And you know, you have people who are trying to say that we can't use this, right? Because he was a sitting president, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line is, though, like I said, is our theory that some of those provisions were put in place specifically to stomp out the former Confederates mm-hmm. and to, at the same time, raise the freedmen in status to positions of power in the political sphere in this country.
And you also, I'm sure, know about the whole down south. There was a whole cabinet of black legislature legally elected
yes.
who were run out of town mm-hmm. under threat of murder. Tell us briefly about that story.
Wow, absolutely. Well, that's what I was just speaking on. So in terms of stomping out those Confederates, they also began to have, you know, black congressmen, black state reps, et cetera, right? State and local office who began to rise in power. Yeah. But like you said, they were removed by way of force, many of them by force at the barrel of guns in many instances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're returned back to a state of subjugation in a lot of places, and so we, you know, they face racial terrorism, etc. Mm-hmm. A lot okay. of this stuff is, you know, this is the reason why we're in the place that we are is because the remedial justice that was due to our people at that time was reneged upon yes. by this government, you know, by the 1877 compromise, you know, and so. All of these things need to be looked into, and for us, those kinds of things in that particular time period is at the foundation of why we make the type of reparations claim that we do.
Thank you, Brother Charles Ali Bay Harrison. We are coming down to the last minute of this show, literally the last minute of this show, so I appreciate you. Deshaun Naheem Way, I appreciate you. Jonathan. Mm-hmm. Sister Antonia, Queen Antonia, I appreciate you. You're in the studio with us. Can I get you guys a reservation to do a part two? Because we definitely,
yes.
we just scratched the surface. And this is an active,
yes.
active show. And I want to get you guys back on as soon
May
as possible. Real quick, yes,
okay.
ma'am.
So this is the reason why we try to educate the community, because everybody seems to want to write off the coattails of slavery to use that for the catapult to get reparations. Mm-hmm. But they don't want to talk about the legacy of slavery and these things that we're talking about. These things really did happen. So if we go from, okay, we were enslaved, and we go to current day, you're missing all these little pieces for the badges and incidents for the stains of slavery. And that's what we fight for. We want to be recognized for everything that was done to us. And the only way we can do that is get into the community and educate people. And we really appreciate you
for having
us on this platform, because it's just not about cash payment and an immediate remedy. We want to make sure that everything is accounted for.
Thank you so much
for being here
with the studio. Thank you, my brothers, kings and queens that have been here this evening. My name is Sharon Eaton Hinton. We are out of time, unfortunately. Take care of yourselves and each other. The people united will never be defeated, but we have to be united.
Yes.
I met Kwame Ture, Stokely mm-hmm. Carmichael, in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and he said that black folks need to organize. He said, I'm an organizational animal. I formed 5 organizations. Mm-hmm. 3 of them killed me, but that's what we need to do. This is on another level, and hopefully we mm-hmm. brought you there. Take care and God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
One of the biggest in the United States Congress. He had the audacity to send out a Dr. King quote.
The march has begun. Every day we rise like the sun. We
till the battle is won. Can you hear the footsteps? Listen, cause we're coming like a gang on the street, so you better start running. It's time for some action now. Historical progression, generations march in succession. Through 400 years, hate, blood, sweat, and tears, and counting. The resistance is mounting.
What you resist? Put your fist.
Another generation of fighters. When it gets hard, we charge.
Don't test them, resist. Pump your fist. Throw your hands in the air just like this.
We are the igniters. Another generation of fighters. We don't quit, we hit. Don't get it twisted. Black women insisted. Show the world how they resisted. Alabama got rocked.